It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going on a virtual safari. My guests have both just returned from Africa. Jim Heck has lived and worked in Africa since the mid-1970s. His home base in the United States is in Galena, Illinois. He's written a great deal about Africa over the years, including on his blog, AfricaAnswerMan.com, and he's the president of Explorers World Travel, and he is here with me today. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Charity.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And our good friend, wildlife biologist Jim Pease, is also here today. Having recently traveled with Jim Heck, he's back to share his experiences, including whittling down 17,000 pictures into a slideshow for our website. That will be up later today. Hello, Jim.
Jumbo.
Well, and I want to start off the hour with just a conversation about the trip that you took, Jim Pease. So can you describe what this journey was?
Yeah, this was an amazing journey for us. We were on safari with Explorers World Travel, and Jim is our leader for about 30 days in two East African countries that are well known for their abundant wildlife and the great migration in both Kenya and Tanzania. And it was an absolutely phenomenal trip for us. We got to see all the things we had hoped for and more, and it was truly a wonderful experience. We had incredible accommodations, wonderful tent camps everywhere we went, great leadership, amazing variety of wildlife. I got to delve into a whole new ecosystem. I've never been to Africa before. I got to delve into a whole new ecosystem that has all kinds of species, whole families of birds that I've never seen before. So it was great fun for us, and we learned so much in such a short period of time. Thanks to Jim, and thanks to the critters that are still there.
So give us an idea. You were there for 30 days. How right. often did you travel around? Where were you headed?
Well, we traveled first the first couple of weeks in Kenya, and we were in primarily national parks and wildlife areas in Kenya, including such places as Tsavo East and Tsavo West National Parks. That's TSAVO if people want to look it up on their map. Amboseli, the Maasai Mara. It was just amazing traveling between all of these various parks. And then when we went into Tanzania after a couple of weeks, we were also in parks there, including most notably Ngorongoro Crater, the Serengeti, and all, again, national parks and wild areas around there. They're huge wild areas. Much as we think of our Western parks, you know, these are very, very large wild areas that we've, as a society, have set aside for not only for conservation, but also for the enjoyment of people. And the same thing has happened, not in exactly the same way, but in similar ways in Eastern Africa. And so we got a chance to travel each day. We traveled by safari vehicles. These are very rugged 4x4 Land Cruisers and Land Rovers with pop-up lids that you can stand up, and the animals are very acclimated to the presence of these vehicles, even very close to them, and so they sort of ignore them as long as you're pretty quiet, and they're used to the vehicles and the clicking of cameras, and so you can get quite close to them and have some amazing opportunities to see and watch them do their thing, be it from sleeping to eating to breeding, you know, all the things that go on in their daily lives. We get to see at least some of that.
How large a group were you traveling with?
Our first group was, what were there, Jim? Eight people, I think.
Yeah, we had eight, right.
Yeah, eight for the first couple of weeks. Got a couple people left then at the end of that, and then more of us joined. So we had 15 the second 2 weeks, and in primarily in Tanzania.
Now, of course, when you take people on a tour, they want to see wildlife. So, Jim Heck, how do you arrange that? How do you know where to take people, where they'll actually get to see these creatures?
Well, there's a very good reservation system for the animal control unit. Actually, there are patterns that we've come to learn over the years. There's migratory patterns. There's habitat patterns. And so with a good amount of experience, you can pretty well guarantee somebody's principal decision to see elephants or see lion or something of that sort. Don't forget, these are protected, controlled areas that have been protected and controlled for more than a half of a century, all of them, some of them even longer. And so the animals, as Jim rightly said, are rather acclimated to tourists. Now, I personally like to get to the ones that are less acclimated, but many of them are, and there are ways that you can pretty well guarantee to see certain things at certain times.
Does it ever feel, I mean, this is an enormous expanse of wildlife, does it ever feel crowded? Are there so many tourists that you kind of wish you could get away from people?
Absolutely. Probably the best case is the one that all of our presidents and presidents' wives have visited, and that's in Ngorongoro Crater in Tanzania. 101 square miles at its height. It has 24,000 animals, but also at any given high season day, it may have up to 1,000 people in anywhere up to 50 to 100 vehicles, or more. And so, yes, those are crowded areas. I personally like to avoid them, and it's very easy to avoid them. That isn't the average day, but it does happen. But there's a reason for that, and that's because it's been such a successfully protected ecosystem. So as crowded as it seemingly is, it has the largest density of lion. The only place left in Africa where there are wild black rhino in free-ranging ways without fences around them. So it's a reason to see. And these are not animals that you open the door and touch.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these... No, definitely not.
So I'd say most of the time it isn't, as people worry, crowded. But there are some times where you should suffer that to see this marvelous experiment.
Well, Jim Pease, as Jim Heck was saying, that, you know, people go on this journey with a decision that they want to see a particular animal or have a particular experience. And I know that this is a trip you've been dreaming of taking for a very long time. What was on your list? What were your priorities?
Well, certainly I wanted to see the big cats. I've been very, very fortunate in my life to experience that in, you know, as you well know, and most of our listeners know, I've traveled a lot in Central and South America, taking groups there, first of students and then later of older students, adult groups to Central and South America. And we've gotten the chance to see things like up close and personal, like pumas in Patagonia and jaguars in Brazil and the Pantanal, lots and lots of birds in Costa Rica and Panama and in the Amazon, and so all of those things are really special to the place, and so I really wanted to see the big cats that were special to the place in Africa where we're going to be, and certainly lions, leopards and cheetahs were on my list, and everything else as well. Lots of birds that I've always wanted to experience. The big Cory bustards, for example, are just magnificent strutting males on the prairie. It's just incredible.
Now, that's very unique, Jim. There aren't a lot of people who want to see a Cory bustard, so I'm very glad to hear that.
Oh, it was fabulous. You know,
well, so, I'm sure a lot of people want to see them. They just don't know it yet.
They don't know they want
that's
to see
it.
Them. So, you know, it's certainly the big cats. And actually, you know, I was surprised at how much we saw lots and lots and lots of elephants, hundreds of elephants in various places. And seeing the variety in both size, depending on the, you know, what's available to them to eat, and the health of the herds. And, Yeah, a lot of discussion about the size of the tusk and why the overall tusk size is much smaller now, and things like that. I was, you know, elephants didn't seem that unusual to me, although we don't see them on the Iowa landscape. I grew up seeing them in the circus, of course. But I was surprised myself a little bit at how much I enjoyed watching them in their natural habitat and the sort of the interactions between them. So I really enjoyed those and everything. But the big cats were especially on my list, and we weren't disappointed at all.
So tell me about an encounter with a big cat.
Well, the one that comes to mind, of course, is the cheetah. And the cheetah female, we're fortunate to see several cheetahs. In fact, we saw six different ones in one day. But we came upon, I think Jim, you saw it, or the driver saw it over across, saw her sitting up across the grassland in the Serengeti. And we drove across then to see her very up close with, and she had two cubs with her, and they were feeding on a young a wildebeest that had been killed earlier that morning or previous night. And so there are actually a couple of pictures on the website with the female and one of her cubs and another cub that has a nice red nose from recent feeding.
Had not washed his face yet.
Had not washed his face, that's right. So seeing them up close and watching them interact as a family was quite interesting, and then realizing that she was keeping a watch out because she wanted to make sure she fed quickly before hyenas came and took the prey away from her. A group of hyenas, what, five or six, could easily take that prey away from the cat or kill one of the cubs. So she was keeping a watch out for others. So that was a pretty spectacular moment for us.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about Africa. Jim Pease, wildlife biologist, has just returned from a trip to Africa. And his guide, Jim Heck, is also here with us today. He's the president of Explorers World Travel and blogs at AfricaAnswerMan.com. And you are welcome to join our conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Africa. Both of my guests have just returned from Africa. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease spent about 30 days there on an amazing trip through Kenya and Tanzania. And his guide is also here with us today. Jim Heck is the president of Explorers World Travel. He blogs at AfricaAnswerMan.com. And we're talking about the journey that they took. You're welcome to join the conversation as well with any questions you might have, or if you've been to Africa, experiences that you'd like to share. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim Pease, the experience you were just telling us about at watching this family of cheetahs interact, is it because you got to see their behavior, their interactions with each other that made that such a special experience?
Yeah, I think it's that and the fact that, here's a very a big cat existing in its natural natural environment, able to feast or famine, depending on what the critters are that are around, and they were able to feast at the time that we were there because they were very successful during what is known as the Great Migration. And this is a migratory herds of many thousands of grazing animals, particularly wildebeest and zebra, but also some gazelles and a few other things, topis and elands, actually travel from the south to the north with the rains as the rains gradually green up some of the prairie, and so they have to move across just as And this is the amazing thing to me. When you look at North America, we used to have herds that did the same thing. They were called bison and elk, and they responded to the some of the same cycles of life that that in Africa that cycle is still intact. And so the cheetah family was able to fulfill, because as these herds travel, they have young along the way, and the young are much easier to catch. The cheetahs, for example, were feasting on a young wildebeest and readily available to them. But of course, as those herds disappear, then the cheetahs have to subsist on other things, and so their existence is much more tenuous. So when you think about sort of the whole cycle of their life, we saw them at the best when they could have young and bring those young up because there's plentiful food available. But knowing that maybe a few months down the road, that's not going to be the case for them. That prey will not be so easy to come by. So, to me, the other thing that was interesting for me is that looking at Eastern Africa has probably the largest concentrations of these megafauna that has attracted tourism and tourism dollars for decades, perhaps longer. Jim, I don't know, and it's certainly succeeded in preserving a very large area, wild area, and in fact, that's what's happened elsewhere in my travels. But is that enough? Is that the tourism isn't enough to sustain conservation? It was one of those things that kept coming back to me as I thought about each day what we were seeing and how we were seeing it, not just the critters themselves and how magnificent that was, but also thinking about how this whole system works and will it work down the road in the future? And those are some interesting questions to ponder.
We'll dig into those questions a little bit later in the hour, but I want to talk about the Great Migration because it's something that, of course, a lot of us have seen in Disney movies. That's where most of us have encountered this idea. But Jim Heck, this is a regular behavior and it must be an incredible sight for anybody who encounters it. As a guide, how do you know where to find it?
Well, it's getting harder with climate change, to be sure. But the Great Migration, even today, is really the last great wildlife spectacle on Earth. Now, if you can get up to the porcupine caribou herd up north or the ones in northern Canada, you'll see something that's a fraction but similar. And when I say similar, it's because you can't see 2 million animals at once. When we're on top of a hill in the otherwise flat Serengeti and there's wildebeest from horizon to horizon, we're really only seeing probably at most a 250,000 and probably a little bit less. But there's four times that in that particular area at any one time. So it's the biggest wildlife spectacle that exists. And you might wonder, how can we not find it? but the area in which the Great Migration moves back and forth is about 7,000 square miles. So it's roughly the area of a third of the eastern Iowa. And it does move more or less together. Historically, it did. And it did, as Jim was saying, properly with the rains. So the rains were predictable. They receded in time over the calendar year. So we could basically make a pretty good guess as to where they would be, and we were very successful. Now, with climate change, especially around the equator, it's raining a lot more than it ever did. And the rains are more torrential, and they're often followed by droughts. And one of the things it's doing is fracturing the great herds because they either don't have to move or they have to move more quickly than they used to. So it's a bit of a challenge today. And Jim may remember that we put out feelers to all the guides in the area. I was on the internet. I was on my cell phone. Hey, John, do you know where the Great Migration is? It's Wednesday. We have 2 more days here. And we had a pretty good idea of where it was, but then somebody suggested, well, let's go out and see wild dog tomorrow. The migration wasn't supposed to be in the area we were at the day. And so we did, and we got further and further away from our lodge and further away from lunch. And I told the people, this, to see these dogs, we're going to have to maybe miss lunch. What do you think? Everybody, I think led by Jim, said, said stay out, stay out. We're full enough. So 6 hours after searching for wild dog, we hit the Great Migration in an area it shouldn't have been, in an area I've never seen it before.
Wow.
And it was because of climate change.
So, Jim Pease, tell me what you were thinking when you encountered the Great Migration. What was it like for you?
I was smiling, I think, from ear to ear, and just in sort of disbelief that I could ever see this. You know, you hear about this your whole life, particularly as a wildlife biologist, and to see it up close and personal was just amazing. It's not, you know, like the buffalo stampede on Dances with Wolves. These are animals that are spread out, not in single file, but in more or less a line. But there's not just one line. There are several lines as you're looking across the prairie. And we were looking in front of us. We would have lines of thousands of mixed zebras and wildebeest right in front of us, many of them with young, walking along, grazing as they went and heading north. And there'd be another line maybe, I don't know, a kilometer or two away of similar, but maybe mixed in with some elands and other gazelles. And it is absolutely amazing. A smile on from ear to ear on my face and my wife's face and everybody's face, because get a chance to just happen upon that was amazing. So, I don't know any other words.
How long did you stay and watch?
Well, we watched. We ate lunch there, or watched them sort of pass by in front of us, and stop and graze, and ate lunch in the field there, and got to watch them for a couple of hours anyway, and this was all in search of the wild dogs, which we never found, and that was not at all a disappointment because we got the Great Migration instead, and that was pretty amazing. So
Jim Heck, you've encountered the Great Migration many times. Is it still that overwhelming for you when you encounter it?
It absolutely is, Charity. I think that it has something to do with our Midwest roots, where we stand on a tiny little precipice and we looked over horizon to horizon of cornfields and wonder what would it be like if there was something else there.
Yes.
When you see a prairie, and that's what these are, prairies, just like at home, when you see these literally filled with animals, there's just such a rush of insignificance to yourself. I mean, these are millions of animals, as Jim said, going through a story, a routine, a daily life that they've done for millennia. And most of the world pays them no attention. And it's such a magnificent and awesome scene. And when you think that, my goodness, why isn't CBS News here? I mean, why aren't people recognizing this? It's constantly, every single time. And it's different each time. There's something different about it.
You talked about how it's more difficult to find because of climate change. So in the 4 decades or more that you've been traveling in Africa, can you see changes? Is there, when you look at the Great Migration, are differences visible, not just because you're looking at a different group of animals, but because of human changes?
Oh, absolutely. And if you're, yes, not just climate change by human forces, but development and other things. Jim mentioned earlier how it's nice to see acclimated animals, and he mentioned elephants. I see elephants as very stressed today. They're the biggest, of course, of the animals. They're the most affected by human development and by climate change. And so there's a stress among the wildlife of the world that didn't exist 15 years ago, and that's causing all sorts of problems.
Jim Pease, you have been in many wild places around the world, and, you know, we have great wilderness here in the United States where you can feel like you're in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Did Africa feel different to you?
Well, it was different in the sense I would say, size. There were times at which I wondered to myself, gee, am I in eastern Wyoming or eastern Montana? Because the landscape, artificially at least, is similar. It's just so much bigger. When you're in the Serengeti, yes, there are rock outcroppings that you can get up on top of and look across the prairie, just as I have in eastern Montana. And you can look across some of the savannas in places, and it reminded me of the savannas that I've been in the Pantanal in Brazil. So there were certain sort of outward similarities, but the size is so immense that is the thing that I think you don't find a lot of places in the world, and you certainly don't find the abundance of wildlife present that we see on the prairies of eastern Africa. It is a truly an incredible sight, and one I certainly want to encourage anyone who has a chance. You know, it's one of those reasons we travel. I never thought I'd get a chance to go to Africa. It's always been on my bucket list, you know, but I never thought I'd get a chance, and Jim made it possible with his wonderful tours there. And it really is something that people travel to see before it's gone. And a lot of people are traveling today for that very reason. And I hope it exists for a long, long time.
Jim Heck, tell me a little bit about your history, because you have been traveling since and living in Africa since the 1970s. What took you to Africa?
It was a boyhood dream, Charity. Grew up in a crowded suburb. I was a little boy being chased by big boys. And I was hiding, and next to me was a field and stream with a picture of an elephant on it. And I said, that's where I'm going to go. So that's where I spent my life.
So in creating a life where you could travel to Africa and spend time there, what was your goal?
Well, my goal was basically just to see the wild, undeveloped places of the earth. We were fortunate, my wife and I, to come along and have a business that was created at the same time that Americans started to travel. That was really the late 60s and early 70s. That was when the first time that Americans in large numbers began to travel to exotic places. So our goals matched. They dovetailed, and we were able to make a business out of a boyhood dream.
And over time, I mean, you've taken many, many groups to Africa over the years. How have you seen tourism in Africa change?
Considerably. It's become much more commercial. It's become much less customer-related and much more business-related, and I really don't like that particular trend. But there's a lot of it that has to do with the development of the places that these exist in, like the African countries. The development in Africa has been profound, much faster than it's here in the United States or in Europe. And when a person in their own lifetime is born onto a prairie's edge where there's a few wild animals in a little grass hut and finds out that his children are in a three-room home with air conditioning and Wi-Fi, he no longer wants those wild animals in his backyard. And so that's caused a real stress in the environment there. And it's put tourism as a foreign activity, as something that is almost anathema to the people who live there. So it's a problem. It's definitely a problem. The tours themselves, yeah, the experience that a customer gets, I think, is still very similar to the way it was if it's done properly. And in fact, there's three times as many animals today in East Africa as when I was there.
Really?
Yeah.
And why is that?
Because conservation was increased, particularly to drive tourism. So the Serengeti was doubled in size. Large numbers, almost 14,000 Maasai, were displaced from their native lands to make room for parks that tourists could come to. And it had the expected result, which was an increase in the animal population. Now, we've lost some very important animals because wildlife management needs a little bit of a twink here and there that's not doing well in East Africa. But so some of the less known species, forest animals, for example, we've lost some of them. But the overall quantity of animals is greater than ever.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about Africa this hour. With me, Jim Heck. He's the president of Explorers World Travel based in Galena, Illinois. He blogs at AfricaAnswerMan.com. And Jim Pease, wildlife biologist from Ames, Iowa. They have both just returned from Africa, and they're talking about the journey that they took together. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions and with your experiences. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Africa. Jim Pease, a wildlife biologist, emeritus professor at Iowa State University. He often comes on to talk about Iowa's wildlife and natural places, but he's just returned from his first trip to Africa, a 30-day journey in Africa, both in Kenya and Tanzania. And so we're talking about African wildlife. Today, Jim Heck is also here. He is the president of Explorers World Travel. He was the guide on the trip that Jim Pease took. He also blogs at AfricaAnswerMan.com. And you are welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to get into this a little bit. We also have a lot of people who want to join the conversation. But, you know, Jim Heck, you were starting to describe what is an incredibly complicated system problem force in Africa, where tourism has driven conservation, and in many ways that has also benefited the people of Africa. In other ways, it's been a force that the people of Africa have pushed back against. I mean, this is a very complicated issue.
It's a very complicated issue, and the reason is because in the beginning, tourism was an important factor in the economy of these countries. So when I started, there was actually a day in 1977 when revenues from tourism were the greatest of any sector that Kenya received. Today, it's down to about number 7 or 8, as there's high tech and there's mining and there's education and banking. And so it's no longer as important to the economy of these countries as it once was. That's the principal reason. It's a simple matter that the revenues just aren't there like they used to be. So the attention given to the sector is much less.
Yeah, Jim and I talked about this on the trip, in fact, in my many travels to Costa Rica. In the mid-90s, tourism in Costa Rica first began to exceed in importance to the gross national product, exceeded all of their agricultural products. It exceeded coffee, bananas, even pineapple. It still is number one today, but after 9/11, and this is a whole other impact on tourism, after 9/11, they had become so dependent by year 2000, 2001, on tourism that they'd sort of forgotten about the rest of the economy. And after 9/11, when for at least 6 months, nobody came, nobody went to Costa Rica, no tourists showed up, and they nearly starved, all of a sudden they said, wait a minute, we have to diversify this economy. And so they brought in San Jose, what is the biggest Intel plant in the world, you know, and they've done other things to diversify the economy. And as Jim's pointed out, in Eastern Africa, they're no longer tourism dependent for the whole economy. And I think overall that's a good thing. But it does bring pressures then upon these wild areas and the wildlife within them. So how do we sustain that down the road? And that's the tough the $64 million question, I guess.
Well, and I think there is a question of values as well, because
sure.
Sitting here in Iowa, I care deeply about the future of African creatures, and conservation in Africa seems very, very important to me. Right. But the tourism industry doesn't threaten my livelihood. I mean, the people of Africa have a different set of priorities. And it's easy to look from here to there and make judgments. But when it's in your backyard and it's part of your culture, it's a very different picture, Jim Heck.
People are looking for your assessment of it. The Africans want more people to make the statement of the sort you just made. They want people to realize that. Yeah, last November's presidential election in Tanzania, elephants was actually a pivotal issue in that election. And the presumption...
In what sense?
Well, there's a presumption today, a correct one, I think, that most of the world feels that elephants are critically endangered. They are endangered. They aren't critically endangered. And I think the Africans know that because we went through a period where they were critically endangered in the 1970s and 80s, and the world, together with the African countries, successfully saved the elephant. Today, poaching is on the rise, but it's not on the rise like it was back then. Yet, in every publication that has an NGO request for money, there's a notion that the elephant is going to go extinct. So the northern part of Tanzania is politically different than the rest of Tanzania. And the northern part of Tanzania is where all the elephants are. Most of the elephants are that tourists see anyway. So there was a division between the political parties on whether or not to spend any time saving the elephants, stopping poaching, or actually arresting the people who were involved in the black market. And the southern politicians, recognizing they were losing the election 3 weeks before the election, arrested in a very public ceremony a person who was the principal black marketeer of ivory. And they got a confession from the woman, a Chinese woman, so that she didn't have to testify in court and no details were learned. Hmm. So it became a very, very critical issue. And it is in Kenya as well, where there's now going to be a road through Nairobi National Park. There's a whole area. Jim was mentioning Tsavo, one of his first experiences. There's a huge high-tech center planned in the area of Tsavo. So there's a lot of need for us in Iowa and elsewhere to empathize and to understand that there's more to it than just, for example, saving the elephant. There's more to that question.
Let's go to the phones. A lot of people want to get involved in this conversation. Lee is on the line in Slater. Hi, Lee.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks. My question has to do with DNA-based research and out-migration from East Africa. I've done a little research and discovered that my ancestors probably left East Africa about 60,000 years ago and ended up in Northern Europe and then in Iowa. I'm curious about other animal species. What do we know about them and how they travel?
Well, wow, great question. He's talking about out-migration of humans and humanoids from East Africa, and we did get to visit the Olgovi Gorge, which was an amazing experience in itself, to see where the Leakeys and some of the human origins, at least one of the primary places of human origins in the world, started. And that was a sort of a breathtaking experience as well, to be there. But he's wondering about whether other similar DNA, and I'm not sure that there have been the DNA studies to look at other critters, out-migration of other species. It's hard enough to do it for humans, let alone for other species. Jim, do you know of anything?
I don't think so. I think, Lee, your research is correct, and it is, as Jim just said, one of the most awesome experiences in East Africa to learn about early man, because that's where it all began there, in the Great Rift Valley, as you discovered. But Jim, I don't think that there's any evidence to suggest that there were animal migrations. I think most of the animal splits were long before that.
Yeah, and certainly there were migrations with the Ice Age 10, 12,000 years ago, and before then, and previous ice ages before that, there were certainly migrations of species driven by the ice. But to whether it served them to populate the world, I don't know that we have any DNA evidence to indicate that.
Well, very interesting question, Lee. Yeah. And here's an email from Chris, and this echoes a little bit of what you were saying, Jim Heck, and takes it a little bit farther as well. He said, my wife and I did Peace Corps in Ghana, finishing our service in 2010. And when we returned, the image that folks had about where we were was pretty much what you're describing, elephants, lions, et cetera. And this is what most Americans think of when imagining Africa. First off, West Africa does not have the same wildlife that the East has. I mean, it's a very large continent. And I feel strongly that people really should be aware of the incredible diversity of the human cultures that are across Africa. Go see the critters, but it's critically important to interact with the people and gain at least a basic understanding of their culture. I feel strongly that these interactions would make this planet a much more peaceful place. And that continues the line of reasoning that you were talking about, Jim, where we don't have a strong understanding of the cultural environment and influences.
What a spot on statement that was. There's some very intelligent listeners calling in. And I think, as Jim will attest, we spend a lot of time, particularly I do, it's a passion I have, on the culture and the history,
right,
the traditional ways, and the importance of the people. So you're absolutely right. And that person is absolutely right.
Bill in Sac City is on the line next. Hi, Bill.
Well, hi, Charity, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Two questions for Dr. Pease. Dr. Pease, of all the nature trips you have taken, where would you put this African trip? And secondly, what undeveloped areas of the world that you have traveled would you put high on the list of places to see and travel?
All right. So you need to rank it for us, Jim.
We'll rank it. It's right up there for me to, as I mentioned earlier, to see a place with such expansive wild place left, where animals and humans, the Maasai culture in particular, sort of live out their lives on this huge prairie, was an amazing, truly incredible experience for me, and so it's right up there with my experiences in Central and South America and other places I've had the wonderful opportunity to travel. Places that I want to go, there are still lots of places that I'd love to go. As long as my health and my money holds out, I'll do that. So spending the kids' inheritance, you know.
Right.
It's one of those goals to see the wild places and to understand the context in which they exist. And that's the thing that for me, for Jim and I think, you know, we enjoyed a lot of sort of intellectual repartee during the trip, talking about these various issues. And we hope that this radio program, among all the things that are also articles and whole books that are written about tourism and that, maybe stimulates some of that thought about what happens? Is tourism enough? Where do we get cultural understanding? And how do we rank that cultural understanding along with the ecological understanding? Are they one and the same, you know, even on a given trip? So I try and infuse my trips also with some history and culture along with the wildlife viewing, be they in Central and South America or elsewhere in the world, Australia, wherever. So I try to do some of that same sort of thing. Jim is absolutely the expert of it in understanding the politics and how the politics of wildlife. Gee, that can't be in the same sentence, can they? Interact along with it is a very important understanding, I think, for people to have.
We're nearly out of time, so I'm going to ask Marjorie in Leon's question for her. She wants to know if you had protection when watching the animals. So you're encountering animals that could possibly consider you to be a prey species.
Yeah, there's no question. When you're dealing with large predators, be they lions or jaguars or pumas or grizzlies or polar bears or hyenas and leopards and tigers, that you have to realize they can eat you, you know. So you don't mess around. You don't get out of the car. You stay in the vehicle. They're accustomed to the vehicle, And the vehicle is your protection. You don't lean your head way out the window and inviting them over. You don't try to pet them, anything like that. So yeah, the protection is sort of the blind, if you will, of the vehicle. Jim, would you say other things at all?
No, I think that's absolutely true. Now, the animals today are a little bit more used to people than
right.
they used to be, and you have to be careful where you go. There's some places where they aren't used to you.
Yeah, you don't go out for an I didn't go out for an early morning bird walk like I would in many other places.
No, but you did step down towards some safari ants that almost got you, as
that's
I remember.
True. That's true. Yeah, yeah, the little ones can get you maybe as bad as
well,
the big
mosquitoes,
ones.
Of course, also.
Can... Yeah, tsetse flies, yeah. So.
Well, we have just a couple of minutes left. And Jim Heck, I mean, you've written a great deal about Africa. You blog regularly. You've written books. You clearly want to share your experiences and educate people about what you've seen and experienced. For someone who's sitting in Iowa, what do you want us to know about Africa? What's your highest priority?
I think the highest priority is to recognize that the Africans are the last great stewards of the wild. Now, we've done a good job here. I think our national parks are marvelous. But the wilderness in Africa was uncontrolled until 40, 50 years ago. And so that let it blossom into the greatest wilderness on earth. And it's now the stewards. It's the stewards of that are really the Africans. And we have to engage them rather than just order them. And if we can do that, if we can work together as a lesser partner, I think we'll save the world's greatest wilderness.
Jim Pease, from this experience, I mean, you brought back amazing pictures. I know that you kept a diary to share with your family the entire time you were there to share this experience with your grandkids while you're spending their inheritance. But so what do you want us who are back at home thinking about African wildlife, what should we know?
Well, I think we need to apply what is happening in Africa to our own parks and wild areas here in the U.S. and think about it in terms of the rest of the world. And Jim's absolutely right. They're the ones, the Africans are the ones that are living with it on a daily basis. So in the past, we've had tourism which has helped us save wild areas. But as human population increases around the world very rapidly, we have sort of this convergence of population increase, of development, of technology, cultures, and wildlife. We have this potential collision in the making. And I think we need to think about this very seriously as a society, as a world society, as well as here in Iowa, about is tourism enough? What are the kinds of values and things that will help sustain conservation and wild areas in the future?
Jim Pease, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We'll talk about Iowa wildlife next month.
All right.
All right. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And Jim Heck, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Charity. Thank you.
Jim Heck is the president of Explorers World Travel based in Galena, Illinois. He also blogs at AfricaAnswerMan.com. We had help from Nick Brinks in Ames today. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.